Welcome to Season 3 of Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on building up the local food supply and establishing food security and sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmek people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Jedediah Weeb, co-founder with his partner Louise LeCouf of Elderberry Grove Farms. Welcome, Jed.
Thanks, Warren. It's great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you back. Last week, we talked about your background, the trajectory that you, as just about everybody has, in getting to the place where you're now. And I'll just highlight a couple of things from that, because we talked about a lot of stuff, but some of the stuff is really quite fascinating and relevant to what we're going to talk about today. First of all, coming from a Mennonite background with your father and parents who became Christian hippies, which I think will probably be a phrase that sticks with people listening to the show for years to come. Parents who traveled around the world in a Volkswagen van, possibly a Westphalia. We have not yet identified the exact model, but that's the one that most people used. And then, of course, on foot with their backpacks, but now live on a 20-acre farm near Salmon Arm. And about the fact, we talked also about the fact that you'd been inspired by a particular phrase from Karen Armstrong. It sort of kind of became a bit of a touchstone for you. And the phrase, the sentence was this: the true path to happiness is to dedicate to something higher than oneself. Now, I think there's a lot of people listening to this show who would probably echo that sentiment. But it's an interesting thing that you spelled it out so explicitly that that was something that mattered to you and still does, I would presume.
Oh, absolutely. I preach it on every street corner. I would like to jump in and say, though, I think that's Dan Dennett, not Karen Armstrong.
Well, you know what? A good phrase can come from any source. And if it resonates, who said it is less important than the resonance. We also talked about the fact that the trees have always played, as far as you can remember, an important part of your life. And I want to talk about that a little bit now, because there's a particular place on Elderberry Grove Farm that is the place where your love of trees has its most enthusiastic expression, and that is your hobby zone. This is not part of the actual elderberry plantation. It's part of where you and your relationship with trees expresses itself. Could you tell listeners a little bit about your hobby zone, what it is, what it means to you, and what's going on there on an ongoing basis?
Ooh, yeah, I could. My hobby zone, well, a little bit of it overtakes all sorts of corners of the farm, down the driveway, in the yard, but it's mostly concentrated in an acre and a half down close to the highway. And there's a beautiful creek running through it, and it's got all sorts of different zones within it, sand and gravel and more moist ground. And I've planted, I just keep stuffing trees in there. I keep finding a spot. I've been collecting edible fruits, nuts, and berries. There's about 200 varieties. And it really happens because I have, I'm sure listeners have heard of people who they have a gardening addiction and they buy a plant and then try and figure out where to put it afterwards. So that's exactly what happens, but mine is totally tree focused, you know. So I have, you know, 19 different variations on the walnut theme, for example, it could be, and I have a dozen more to go. I don't know where they're going to get put, but sometimes in my mind, I like to think of it as sort of a repository for varieties of food-producing trees that can grow in the Shuswap, keeping them alive in case anybody ever needs some, sort of a little library or a collection. And part of it is knowing how to propagate them. So they're ready.
They're ready, and they're obviously going to have new companions in the not too distant future. What could you, if I know this is a sort of an existential question, but if you were trying to identify what it is about trees that has drawn you into their orbit and kept you there. I mean, there are many living things on the planet, but trees have a special role. Everybody knows that. They sort of bring energy down from the heavens and put it into the earth. But what for you is what would you say the key?
I don't really know. It's a little bit unexplained why I've always had a little bit of a obsession for trees. But intellectually, I know I love the fact that they produce food that can be grown without tilling the ground. And I think that is so fantastic because it reduces topsoil loss. But I've also been learning a lot lately about how trees feed the soil food web, which is a whole web of different organisms that create an ecosystem in the soil that builds the soil. And it's kind of fundamentally what makes soil different from dirt.
Sure.
And I've learned that trees actually give up 60 to 80% of their energy, the sugars that they harvest from the sun, just to feeding that network in the ground. So they invest in the future.
Indeed. And trees in this part of the world are in a different relationship with the soil compared to tropical countries, where the richness of the soil is quite shallow and the energy is in the trees. But in this part of the world, the temperate world, the soil is where it's estimated by soil biologists. That's where it's all happening. It's in the soil. And if the soil is good, then everything else will be good. I'm sure Elderberry Grove, for a long time, will bear an imprint of this love of trees, because it is obviously elderberries are little trees.
Well, they are, in fact. And if we did, depending on how we prune them, we can actually make them. We could make them into trees. Certain varieties are pruned as little trees, but other ones, even though they naturally would kind of like to be trees, we. Big areas, the rows, they're more of a hedgerow and they're like bushes. But yeah. I never know what to tell people when they ask, is elderberry a tree or a bush? Well, can be either.
They're my friends. You could say that. They're my friends.
Yeah.
Some of my friends are trees and some are bushes. But
let's go ask them.
Yes, exactly. Talk to them, for heaven's sake. Now, Louise won't be on the show today, but I just think it's important to bring her in a little bit. Louise, is an Anglophone Quebecer from the Eastern Townships. And
that's right.
She also got the same degree as you. I think they reversed the terms. Sociological anthropology as opposed to anthropological socialism or something. But also did a degree very similar to yours at Concordia, though. She did it at Concordia University. Did you know that? How soon did it take you two to recognize that you both had the same quote academic background?
I think it came up in conversation pretty early on. Yeah. Some similarities.
And along with the fact that she'd been a tree planter as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting how so many, when I've talked to people on this show, how their life pattern sort of veers towards one another and then just happens. It's sort of like the most natural thing in the world. She was also, is also interested in herbalism, and that was a bit of a path towards what you're doing now. I know that it didn't take long for you to start to think about how you wanted to live generally. And we talked a little bit last time, but also this, I think it's worth mentioning a little bit, this desire to live simply and be self-sufficient, especially with respect to food. This appears to have been something that really motivated the both of you sort of early on, before Elderberry Groves started up. It was sort of a matrix in which you planted the plantation, as it were. It's been part of your life?
Yeah, we both were just feeling like a strong passion towards the idea of being self-sufficient as sort of a path towards sustainability. So we were growing our garden bigger and bigger all the time. At one point, we did produce most of our own food, not meat. That hasn't been as much of an interest as plants for us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, of course, you're going to the grocery store for spices and oils. But we were really, really into, just before we started, pivoting to having an elderberry business. We were really into all sorts of food production for ourselves. We were growing as much food as we possibly could just to see if that, well, it's in a sustainable way to go. And it's a good thing to learn about and to share knowledge with so that more and more people can garden.
While you were doing this, you were also starting to think about how you would create some kind of business, some kind of work life, as well as your daily lives, you know, personal lives. And it started with elderberries because you'd had an experience with elderberries. Both of you had an experience that had shaped your thinking about the plant and about yourselves and about health. Just describe that a little bit.
Well, Louise, with her interest in herbalism, and me with my interest in, you know, eating any wild plant that I possibly could from a young age, we both knew about elderberry, and we decided we would make some elderberry syrup, and we had it on hand for the winter cold seasons, and we started using it every time we thought we might be catching a cold, and we just couldn't believe how tangible the results were.
You couldn't catch a cold with it on hand, is what you're saying.
Well, I think, you know, it's more common to use elderberry once you feel like you are already catching a cold. It's not too late, because elderberry, it does have some flavonoids in it that, you know, that directly contradict viruses. So even if you've already caught a cold, you take it, and it makes a difference. And the difference is so noticeable. We just thought, this is something we got to tell everybody about. I grew up thinking, you catch a cold, there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to live with it. You know, I learned that some of those over-the-counter medications, you know, they just suppress the symptoms. They're kind of a scam. You know, they don't really actually help you to heal faster. I thought, you know, there's nothing you can do. But once I started using elderberry, wow, just having it be a lot less of a bumpy road every time I maybe caught a cold or something like that. It just felt great. Like I was free from having to deal with those intense colds that I was starting to get in my 20s, you know.
So you noticed a tangible difference. You noticed a change in the pattern of this sort of the cold season impact on you.
It felt so tangible. Like it couldn't be a coincidence. We thought, this is an amazing plant. It really does something.
You'll be pleased to know that I actually have a sheet of information in my office on non-pharmaceutical remedies for the common cold. And I think I'm going to add elderberry syrup to the list, along with vitamin C and a few other things. So you guys thought about various things as well. You thought about traditional Chinese medicine herbs, because there's a lot of, I mean, the pharmacopoeia for traditional Chinese medicine is huge, something like 4,000 entries. But then eventually you kind of focused your attention around elderberry. And then you started to take steps to start up a business. You mentioned to me about buying 1,000 cuttings from River Hills Harvest in Missouri from a gent named Terry Durham. And Terry Durham and you established a relationship fairly quickly that has continued to this day. Why don't you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, I usually think of Terry as our mentor, and he's kind of is the mentor for almost everybody growing elderberry in North America. He, along with two agronomists at the University of Missouri, thought they were drinking a bottle of elderberry wine one night, and they all looked at each other at once and with kind of the same realization dawned on them, and they said, why isn't anybody growing this native berry as a crop? So they were the first ones to do it, with Terry as the experienced lifetime organic farmer. And it more and more farmers caught on, and more farmers started doing it, and he's kind of the grandfather of growing elderberry in North America. People have been doing it for six decades already in Europe.
One thing I like interpolate here is that it is well known that when you grow plants organically, the content of not just bioflavonoids or flavonoids, but also terpenes and terpenoids, which are another class of antioxidants, is much higher because these are defense compounds that help the plant resist predation by various insect species. They also, terpenes and terpenoids, are also the flavor sources in many plants. And as a result, they make organically grown food much more flavorful, which with respect to elderberries, would be very important. You want the flavor to be as enhanced and as come through as strongly as possible. So yeah. you hit the elderberry trail running, it sounds like it. When you first met Terry, what kind of a guy is he? I mean, what, is he old? Is he young? Is he commanding? Is he self-effacing? What kind of guy?
Terry is, the kind of guy that I want to be when I grow up. He's pretty cool. He's, if I'm 35, I guess he might be 35, might be twice my age. And he had a lifetime career as an organic market gardener and then decided to get into elderberry. So he's been an activist in the organic movement and an activist for food security and just sustainable living. And he is just a genuinely nice guy, but he can bring together people to move towards a common goal. He has a really nice presence and people like to be around him.
What did he tell you that helped you? Like when you're just starting out, you're obviously trying to do it right. What were some of the things he told you that were important to do? Things that would help things move ahead the way you wanted them to? Obviously, you had some shared values in probably multiple ways. But what did he tell you that kind of helped you focus your path, as it were?
I think the main thing was just letting us know that it is possible. You can make a business about this plant. That I was already passionate about elderberry, and I had thought to myself, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could farm this as a farm business? And he said, yeah, you can. And, he just spent a little bit of time with us just telling us how to plant them, how to grow them and harvest them. And he was a real believer in organic, and he told us, he said, yeah, this is a plant that is really well suited to growing organically. So gave us the confidence, and we ordered a pile of cuttings, and we committed January of 2017. We placed the order, and then we let the details figured we'd sort them out in between then and spring.
And it was 1,000 cuttings. It wasn't a small order. You were taking a stake in this project. It was a big one.
Absolutely, we really did, and they grew well. And then the next year we figured, hey, let's try some more. And then that's how we got into having so many different varieties.
Now, you also became involved in the Launchpreneur program that's run through the college, through Aspiral Associates. That became another event in this journey. Describe how that went. How you got into
right
it.
Right after we made the decision to become, to give it a try as farmers and picked elderberry, we heard about the Launchpreneur program and we thought, wow, geez, I mean, that sounds perfect. We should really sign up. So we signed up, we went to the classes, and we learned how to make a business plan. With the instruction that they gave us, we made a good business plan. It really was pretty good. And basically, we just learned some essential business skills from that. And it was perfectly fit into our timeline. It happened just at the right time.
What were the features that you... Because later on, it became clear that the plan... When you're making a plan, it's the first time, you don't know how good it's going to be. But later on, it became clear that it was. What were the things that you did in that plan that turned out to be really spot on, that really were valuable for where you were going.
Well, I mean, in the plan, we did spend a little time developing our own enterprise model, just figuring out how long it would take between planting to getting a crop, you know, how much crop the first year and the second year, and how many dollars are going to be invested in the first and second year. So that we did a little work on that. But also, they just encourage you to get out of the building is a phrase they really use a lot in Launchpreneur, at least the year that we were there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what we did. We didn't wait for our elderberries to produce. We went out and we harvested wild elderberries, and then we started going to markets. And our first one was the seed swap, which I think is coming up next week.
Indeed.
In next Saturday in Enderby, the Lions gazebo.
Yes, indeed.
And so we got out of the building and we started to interact with people, find out what they liked, and we bottled some product and sold it to see how people would respond. And we pretty quickly learned what kind of things appeal to people. You know, people like organic, for example. They prefer something natural like honey instead of using a refined sugar. So The Launchpreneur program encouraged us to get out and learn from our future customers.
When you actually got into the Launchpreneur process, which is a process, I mean, you go to classes and then you have an event, and the event is where you share your plan and what your hopes are with your fledgling business. There were some differences between your plan and some of the other plans that were there. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because that was quite significant.
I think what you're getting at, Warren, you and I were talking about this, was that one of the judges asked us during the final presentation, you know, how, if our business was scalable and if we could, how big could we possibly grow it? And we told them that we didn't plan to do that. We planned to build our business to the size to sustain ourselves, just to be the size of business to fulfill our needs, not to grow indefinitely. And
you weren't going to start up elderberry franchises all over North America on every street corner.
Exactly. And I think in retrospect, that really might have not been our best possible approach in attempting to win the competition. Maybe we should have told them that we were going to
be the Kentucky Fried Chicken of elderberries.
Yeah, compete with the mill as far as employer for the town. Then we might have got first place.
Well, maybe it was just as well that you didn't, because then you would have to live up to that kind of expectation. But also, there was this kind of holistic overtone to what you were doing. It wasn't sort of how can we maximize profit per se. It was more how can we do the best, most comprehensive job. How did that go down with the judges? Did that resonate, or was that something seemed a little bit off to one side from what they would have considered the primary goal of a business?
You know, I don't know. I can't speak to that. I mean, they did give us fourth place, so they obviously, you know, they gave us a place on the podium.
Yeah.
But I mean, they liked what we were doing well enough, but it seemed like maybe the businesses that had the business plans that did talk more about being infinitely scalable did place ahead of us.
When you think about that, I mean, we can allow a certain sense of nostalgic regret that maybe we didn't come in first and wow them. But on the other hand, in order to have done that, perhaps you would have had to compromise some of the values that you really wanted to incorporate into your business. Looking back on it and seeing where things have actually gone, and that the fact that the business is doing well and that you didn't fall into that trap of saying, yes, we want to be infinitely scalable, how does it feel to know that you didn't follow that path, but you did follow a path that's actually been quite successful, quite meaningful?
Well, we wanted to grow organically, as they say. You know, we wanted to fill a niche where we're just producing products made from berries that we grew ourselves, you know. So it's truly local, and we love making local food for local folks. It feels quite, you know, it feels really good, and it seems to be a business plan that works.
So it hasn't, which is very nice. I mean, to have a business plan that works for you as well as working, in the general sort of mix of things, I think nothing could be finer than that. You actually can say, this is what we wanted to do, and we're doing it. So,
yeah.
When you'd done the Launchpreneur program, you then turned to Young Agrarians Matching Program. Now, that was a different kind of experience. It was more comprehensive, and it brought you into a stronger position. Why don't you describe how that worked with Tessa? Tessa Wetherill, but we think her name may have changed because she's recently been married, but Tessa Wetherill at the time you were working with her.
So the Young Agrarians Land Matching Program has been huge for us. That is the most, you know, significant and coolest program that we've that we've worked with. We, you know, at first our business plan kind of, we were really good on most of our projections. We were almost perfect, but we didn't really quite calculate what our yields would be per acre, right? So we ended up having to realize we needed to expand and access.
You were doing better than you thought you would, and
needed to expand. Yeah. What I mean to say is we needed to expand the acreage that was in production in order to be able to achieve the number of pounds per year we needed to grow in order to be a self-sustaining business.
Okay.
So, you know, we bumped up against this problem that is absolutely rampant across the province, and I think across the country, is that it's so, so hard for young people and young businesses to have access to land because the cost of land is so high. So we found out that you can lease land from people, and not only that, but there is a program, a land matching program, where you have a matchmaker.
Yes.
And that's Tessa's job, who helps make matches between people who have land and would like to see it being used for agriculture and people who need some land to grow their crops on.
So, Tessa compared her job to that of a wedding planner and a sort of organizer of relationships. She said it's very rewarding, and you're describing the same thing. So how did it pan out? What emerged from that process of matching?
Well, right off the bat, you find out that you're working with someone who's experienced in that, Tessa, who has so many ideas and good things to talk about before you get into an agreement, and just helped us to figure out how to write an agreement that actually makes sense, where you thought out the different things that could come up in the future and how you would deal with them. You know, you might think, yeah, I'm going to lease from my neighbor and you can do it yourself. But oh, man, she just makes it, they, Young Agrarians, Land Matchers, they make it make so much sense, you know, and it's easy. And now we lease two fields and we have really good lease agreements.
So when you finally configured the farm, what was it configured as?
It is configured as three separate fields, one field on family land, where we leased from my folks, and one field just down the road that's another small field, and then a little bit of a bigger field up on Broadview. So we have three fields, and it's a total of 5 acres.
And those 5 acres sound like they might have slightly different topography, slightly different microclimates.
Describe
how they differ, because obviously this is the sort of thing that when you're being holistic, you got to bring them all in together and consider them all. What did you notice?
Oh, my goodness. Well, after a couple of years, we learned that our soil here at the home farm wasn't the most fantastic, a little bit a little bit too moist, but also a little bit too alkaline, or in other words, not acidic enough for elderberries. So when we looked to lease land, we kept those values at the top of the checklist. So we did, and we also found some really nice sunny locations, good air drainage, and just these what seemed to us as potentially ideal locations.
Okay. And the other two spots, were they somewhat better quality soil or more suitable for specifically for elderberries?
Well, we think so, but of course we're, you know, we were only 5 years experienced elderberry farmers. We haven't been doing it for a whole lifetime yet, but at least they're somewhat diverse. So maybe, you know, on a wet year, one field will do better, and on a dry year, the other field will do better. And that's sort of more holistic. It provides some more balance and some more assurance against a crop failure.
You know, Jed, I love the timeline when you're growing things. You know, it's only been 5 years. In many forms of business would be like, you know, the half the lifetime of the business. In growing things, it's just getting a little bit more acquainted with what you have to know about the land and the relationship between the land and the weather and what you're trying to grow. So you've got these three acreages. What was your, when you started planting elderberry plants, how did you go about it, and what is the kind of configuration of the planted areas now that you've set up?
So the elderberries are in rows. You know, it's kind of like a little bit like an apple orchard. But instead of, well, they're I guess it'd be more like a blueberry orchard, you know, rows of little bushes.
Isn't it funny how we humans like to have things in straight lines? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's convenient, but...
It is very convenient. It allows me to, between the elderberries, it allows me to grow these fantastic cover crops. I fill that zone, you know, in between each row, there's a little zone that's filled with all of the best native grasses that we could find, the most specific to our area, as well as, you know, whatever seeds were already in the ground that wanted to grow there. And then we, every chance we get, we encourage, sprinkle some more native seeds in there, and also the legumes, which they fix nitrogen and improve the soil. And so what I like to do is I like to let that mix of grasses and forbs and legumes grow up nice and thick, and then I chop it all up with my mower, and then I provide a fantastic meal for the earthworms, and it's all part of a really nice cycle.
And I understand you rotate your mowing. It's not mowing all at once, it's some and then not others. Describe that a little bit. Rotational mowing.
What I've been doing is rotational mowing, and I hope to keep doing it as long as I have the energy for it. It's where you have every third row gets mowed every, let's say, 3 weeks. So there's always one row that's fully blooming with fantastic food and forage for insects and pollinators, one row that's just started to bloom, and then one that's just been cut. And that way, there's always something in there for those native creatures to eat, that some food that they need, so they're not going through a boom and bust. That would be what would happen if you harvested all the time.
For sure.
The bees love to come our way and hang out because it's consistently available food.
There's a sign up probably telling them to drop over at your place because there's always going to be something on the table. how close are
the flowers singing?
Yes. How close are the rows and how close are the trees in the rows? Are they bunched up together or is there a lot of space around them?
Well, we grow two species of elderberry, the European kind and the North American native kind. Well, they're subspecies. They're very similar. Mm. But the North American ones, they're in rows 12 feet apart. And then they're just grown as a hedge. They're packed in there quite close. We've tried 2 feet. We've tried 18 inches. We've tried 3 feet. You know, it's a real hedge. Mm. And then the European ones, we put them more. Well, I've tried 2 feet and 4 feet. But I intend eventually they'll be thinned out to 8 or 12. Because they'll develop into an actual... tree, and those rows are 15 feet apart because we're looking, again, like I said, at a nice tree, which eventually will become quite skookum and stout in the trunk.
Do you trim it, when you prune it, do you trim it so that it spreads laterally more? Is there, I know in some pruning techniques, that's something that's considered quite important with apple trees, for example. But do you reduce its vertical growth so that you can reach the berries at the top?
Absolutely. That is one of the main reasons for pruning, is to make sure that you can keep reaching all the berries as they harvest. Another reason is elderberries. It just rejuvenates the plant and you get bigger, sort of juicier berries. So the North American kind, we cut them down real low, like a foot for some varieties, and just everything gets cut off, just about mowed down, right? Of course, I do it by hand and selectively with care.
And you talk to them while you're doing it.
I probably talk to myself, at least. But the European ones, it's the same kind of thing, but it is occurring higher up. So they have one single trunk, and then they're kind of a bushy little pom-pom on top.
They're quite cute. They're quite cute.
Oh, they sure are.
Now, theoretically, the European strains are less tolerant of climate extremes, but you actually didn't find that took place, especially when the huge test from the heat dome came upon all of us. What did you notice then? It was a bit unusual.
Oh, oddly, after having been told from every source that they are less tolerant of heat, they actually seemed to have less damage this year from the heat dome than the rest of our North American elderberries.
Overall, how did the all of the elderberry plantation in general do? Did it take was the heat dome pretty traumatic, or did they seem to weather it reasonably well?
Well, yes and no. I mean, one thing I learned, I need to pay a little more attention with watering. So that's a success. I learned something new. I had in my mind how much water to give them, and I didn't adapt when the temperatures changed. I mean, that's like a real lesson. But the plants, like a yes and no to your question, Warren, the plants survived really well, but our crop was reduced. So I would say we had about half the crop that I would have projected or expected for this year. But of course, the quality was really high of those berries. Just fantastic. Really? The plants had they could focus their energy on fewer berries. So what happened is, the plants were fine. The plants remained healthy. But the heat triggered them to stop producing flowers. So they didn't produce as much fruit. So, it wasn't devastating. It just, we'll have to tighten the belt for 1 year and hope for a better crop next year.
Now, you have between the trees, you have this whole ecosystem that is a mixture of various things. And you also pay a little attention to that. You mentioned earlier about the soil food web, and a name that we talked about yesterday was Elaine Ingham and her research and her writing on the subject of the soil food web. You make a particular effort as far as things like reestablishing or enhancing the mycorrhizal, the fungal components in the soil. What kind of efforts are you making that way, or how are you encouraging that process forward?
Well, right off from day one, we did inoculate every elderberry cutting with mycorrhizal inoculants, something that a powder that you can buy.
And how did you do it? Did you dig it in around the tree?
Oh, so we actually, there's a technique we learned from Terry Durham. I'm not sure if he invented it or where it came from, but you make a slurry out of with the biochar, and then you inoculate that slurry with the powder that is spores for mycorrhizal, which means fungal species which have beneficial relationships with plants, like a symbiotic,
indeed,
mutualistic relationship. So we just dip them in there, and then we poke the cutting into the ground.
Okay.
That's how you start a new elderberry.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most listeners are probably aware that Cuba became a hotbed of organic growing after the Soviet Union pulled out of Cuba in 1989. And one of the things that the Cubans did was use soil inoculants to enhance growth of a whole range of crops. It has become a major part, and I think they've led the way in a lot of this work. And it is really quite astonishingly valuable in terms of just so many things related to soil.
Right. And it is an incredibly fascinating emerging field of research. It seems to have been ignored for so long, but now the Soil Food Web Institute, started by Elaine Ingham, they're learning and sharing the knowledge of how plants are fed through symbiotic relationships with all sorts of tiny organisms in the soil. So we're taking every opportunity we can to learn from anyone who knows a little bit about that. And we've even started to practice some of the techniques, even though not officially. We haven't taken an official course and don't really have the official knowledge. We're still going for it. We did a compost this winter. I did 6 yards and I turned it all by hand. And we inoculated it with samples of soil from wild elderberry bushes, from the old growth forest at the top of Larch Hills, and, you know, little, because within those samples, we hoped, you know, fingers crossed, it's filled with a diversity of life-giving, beneficial, either mycelium, mycorrhizal fungi, or beneficial bacteria, or, you know, a whole string of other beneficial things. And so that stuff, those creatures, can be propagated in a compost pile. So the purpose of the pile is to culture these organisms. It's not for the NPK, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The purpose of that compost pile, which we managed very carefully at just the right temperatures, the purpose was to multiply organisms, which I then sprinkled in across the field.
There is a lot of research going on with composting and what goes on below the surface of the soil. Listeners probably have heard the name of Suzanne Simard, who just written a book about her experience showing that conifers receive about 15% of their nitrogen in complex forms from the mycorrhizal web underneath the soil, which comes from deciduous trees. So the deciduous trees feed the conifers. Something that the forest industry has not quite grasped, because it still goes around brushing the deciduous trees. Something which you inform me you're very good at. You're very good at brushing, but you're a reformed brusher. You don't do it anymore.
Yeah, I'm very good at killing those birch trees with a brush saw. But actually, it's interesting that you mentioned Suzanne Simard, because back when I was even a very young teenager, I had encountered that because my mom ran a bed and breakfast, and a team of researchers who were working on that exact study, I believe, would have been one of the teams researching for the knowledge that Suzanne Simard eventually published, did stay at our bed and breakfast for several summers. And already as a young teenager, I was learning about how birch trees feed the other trees.
Sounds like fate was trapping you from all directions. With all the soil amendments and care and attention you put into growing the elderberries, but also the plants that surround them, you now have a line of products that you sell into the market. And why don't you describe the range of what you produce and what you sell and where you distribute it? Because that's quite a panoply of products.
So, of course, like you already mentioned, one of our main things that we sell is elderberry cuttings. So people buy them to start their own elderberry plants. But more in stores, you would see our elderberry syrup. We have two styles of elderberry syrup, a regular elderberry syrup and a shrub style syrup, which is a syrup that's a little bit sour. It's kind of old-fashioned. Mm. And then we sell pure elderberry juice. I guess that's not quite the extent of it. We do have a little bit of elderberry tea for sale sometimes when it's seasonally available through our website. As well, we sell elderberry flowers in bulk to Arbutus Distillery in Duncan.
Mm. And some of the money goes away when you sell the flowers. Where does it go to?
Oh yeah, we decided for all the elderberry our elderflower tea that we sell. We give that all away, whatever money comes in from that. And this fall, we supported Indigenous Climate Action, Shuswap Food, Radical Action with Migrants in Agriculture, and Young Agrarians. And last spring, we supported Raven Trust.
So it's a little holistic business practice. Our business helps other people do the things that they do. That seems to be congruent with everything you've been saying before.
We feel like we have to give back a little bit, at least. You know, it's who would we be otherwise?
Yeah, well, exactly. It's holistic, applies to the human community as well as the plant and soil communities as well. Now, you have, as I understand, about 50 farms and individuals that you have supplied cuttings to, or supply cuttings to on a regular basis. How far do you distribute your cuttings? I know you've talked about local food for local folks, but also, and that's where most of your products go, that are consumables, if you like. But cuttings, people can grow cuttings in lots of different places. So where are people taking your cuttings and planting them?
We, of course, we sell the most cuttings locally, but our website, our web sales of cuttings is Canada-wide. You know, you see lots as far away as Nova Scotia and PEI, but you know, lots of Albertans want to grow elderberry. Tons of Albertans. There seems to be well-loved in across the prairies and Ontario, of course. And believe it or not, this is probably a one-time thing because it ended up being a bit too much work. But believe it or not, we're exporting two large orders to Japan this year for the first Japanese elderberry farms to start up.
It's not exactly where I would have said you were going to send your elderberry cuttings to, but yeah. Very interesting.
There's the
climatic tolerance of elderberries. You said there's some limits to the European varieties, but you've also seen in practical terms that those limits can be transcended without the elderberry bushes being, you know, really, they sort of pull back a little bit, but they don't die or suffer, you know, huge losses. So obviously that would imply that you could ship to lots of places if it seemed appropriate.
Well, the European elderberry, I would really only have confidence in growing it here sort of locally in BC and along the coast. The North American subspecies of elderberry, which is what the majority of our varieties are,
right,
they can at least be grown just about anywhere in Canada. It's good to have a short season. You know, some places in the north, the season might be too short and you might not fully be able to ripen your berries, but hey, you could harvest the elder flowers and make yourself a nice medicinal tea. That same beneficial antiviral flavonoids and anti-inflammatory antioxidants are in the flowers as in the berries. Both are good medicine. And it's a tough plant. It can handle the cold.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking that because, in fact, there's sort of basically the growing season up north is actually can be quite long. I don't know how many listeners remember, but at the turn of the century, the last century, the Yukon was a major source of vegetables for southern BC because of the long growing season, they could grow two crops. So there may be a possibility that they could extend up north. So how many?
I have a friend in Dawson City, Yukon, with an elderberry plant. It lives, remaineth alive. But well, you know, I don't know how well it's doing.
Well, we'll all start praying for the Northern Elderberry Survival Program. Now you have, as I understand, nearly 30 different varieties, about 26, 28 different varieties, and among them you have some favorites. What? How do you determine a favorite elderberry? This is one sibling is favored over another sibling. So I hope they're not listening to this conversation. But what are your favorites and what is unique about the ones that you really love the best?
Oh my goodness, I get asked that question, and I never know what to say. I finally decided to tell people I've narrowed it down to my top 13. And you know, that includes in there are the varieties that were developed by the University of Missouri as well as the varieties that were developed at the Kentville Research Station in Kentville, Nova Scotia in the 50s. And what is fantastic, or the traits that are good, for me, what I look for in an elderberry is, of course, vigorous. You know, like a nice strong plant produces a lot of berries, and you want the berries to ripen evenly. Because the berries, they appear in a cluster, kind of like a cluster of grapes. Except, of course, elderberries are tiny compared to grapes, so there could be hundreds or even 1,000 berries in a cluster. You want them all to ripen at the same time, of course. And in the wild, that doesn't really happen, because who is the main consumer of elderberry products in the wild? Well, it's birds, and they don't care if one berry ripens that time. So if we're growing an elderberry in your garden, you want even ripening. And then, you know, you don't want the berries to just fall off too easily. Traits like that. Other traits would, of course, be disease resistance, and just because we're in Canada, early ripening.
Yes, the frozen north, as we are often called. So the values that you've described are these are very practical values that we're talking about. But values in general have been animating this process from the very beginning, and I'm wondering where things like the experimentation that's going on in your hobby zone with all sorts of different trees, what you're observing on the land as it is changed and you change it, and the elderberries, you know, thrive or, you know, don't thrive, or wherever they do. Where do you see things going? Obviously you got to this point through an evolutionary process. What do you see as next steps? Even just kind of a little blue sky speculation where things could go as things evolve with Elderberry Grow Farm and your relationship to it.
Well, I guess, you know, a lot of our fields are pretty recently planted, two out of three. So once that starts to produce, you know, we're really going to be working hard to cold call a few more stores around the province and get our we're in about 30 stores now, but you know, there's probably 240 stores that we could potentially call up and say, hey, would you be interested in so that's something we need to do in the future. It's just sort of grow the production side of the business. And I, you know, I don't really, I'm open to whatever new things that we learn and discover along the way, but we do have kind of a framework for figuring out what's important to us and where we want to go. And it's a basis for how we make decisions. We have what we call a holistic context, and it's just sort of like a framework for us to think about who we are and what we want to do. And whether it fits in with, can I tell you the little
the holistic value proposition?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I tell you?
Three parts: part one, two, and three.
So Elderberry Grove exists to inspire health, to live sustainably and ethically, and to grow ecosystem abundance. So whatever we do in the future, you know, the plan right now is just to see if it fits with those three things. Then, you know, we're happy to do it and explore that direction.
So have you had any sort of aspirational thoughts? You know, when you, for example, okay, let's be concrete. You phone up a store and you say, we have elderberry products, this is what we have. They listen to you. Has that worked out so that they say, that sounds great, bring your products around, they look great, we'll put them on the shelf? Is that a process that inspires you to think, okay, we could maybe grow other things, maybe between the rows we might have, at one point you mentioned that you were jokingly, you might have mushrooms, and you could sell mushrooms because they might grow so well, you know, with all the inoculants and all the attention that the soil is getting, that they might be part of your product mix at some point as well, too, that kind of thing.
Well, that's not entirely a joke. We are attempting that. We do have one row that is fully inoculated, and we will potentially start producing certified organic mushrooms within our elderberries. But, you know, right now it's mostly, let's just get good at one thing at a time. And, yeah, we're still perfecting, and we're still learning so much.
Well, that's getting back to this sort of long timeline that is so central to land-based activities, activities that are embedded in the land, that they're not just on the land, they're actually part of the land. And I think listeners have got a pretty good idea about how we can call it a business because it's making money, but it's also, it's a broader kind of enterprise. It seems to me it's an enterprise that couldn't function without the value system that underpins it. And I think it's the kind of business that is part of the future of not just this part of the world, but the rest of the world. It's a return to the way we have grown things since the dawn of time, since the beginning of growing things. And I think it's funny because you're returning to some older kind of approaches and techniques, but they're actually the vanguard of new approaches. So I want to thank you again for being on the show and for sharing your pretty comprehensive way of approaching growing a particular product and getting better at it all the time. And I hope that this expands into something that you can be even prouder of than you are right now. And I think we're all proud to have you in the shoe shop doing this. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks for chatting with me, Warren. It was really great.
It's been a pleasure.